Welcome back. Good to see you. We have arrived at the fourth evening of our series, which is the last evening of our series. I'm kind of waiting for somebody to throw the switch that makes my laptop screen show up on the wall. There it is. Okay. Let me note, as I have the other nights, that if you'd like a copy of this PowerPoint, which would include all the previous sessions, just email me at dolinger@bju.edu. And in the subject line, put PBP for Palm Bay PowerPoint, and you will get the PowerPoint. Let's see, I'm online, so it should show up within minutes of the time you send that email. We didn't quite finish the material on contradictions from last night, so I want to take a couple of minutes to do that. And then we'll get to tonight's material. We were looking at contradictions, alleged contradictions in the Bible. And I said that if you survey the various lists that are out there, you find that pretty much all of them are examples of logical or rhetorical speechifying fallacies. The last one we were looking at was, and I've used the word ignorance here, I don't mean that to imply anything about stupidity, okay? I don't mean it as an insult. I simply mean that they are ignoring the fact that there's a literary device being used here by a very talented author. And we looked at several of those. We were on, I think we had gotten to this point, hadn't we? Roundness of character. Did we talk about God is a God of war, God is a God of peace? We didn't talk about that. Okay. Can somebody be both warlike and peace-loving? You talk to anybody who's been in combat. My dad was in combat in World War II. You talk to anybody who's been in combat, and nobody loves peace better than somebody who's been to war. Under certain circumstances, for specific ends, God is very much a God of war. And we want a God like that. We all know that when a public situation turns dangerous, you want somebody who knows how to fight and can do it well. And it's unpleasant business, but there need to be people like that. At the same time, God grants peace to His people. This is not a contradiction. This is called a round character. And you learned about that in high school English. And apparently somebody wasn't paying attention that day in school. We talked about this one Sunday morning. God moved David to number the people. Satan moved David to number the people. Well, it's a big situation. The circumstances are not simple. And it is absolutely true that whatever Satan does, God has, at a minimum, sovereignly allowed. And I used the illustration Sunday morning of the death of Christ. The greatest sin ever committed, not only does God allow it, but it is at the center of His plan. The plan does not succeed without the death of Christ. God is way bigger than sin, way bigger than Satan. And I don't see even a theological conflict here, let alone a contradiction. Proverbs 26. Don't answer a fool according to his folly. That's verse 4. Answer a fool according to his folly. That's verse 5. How likely do you think it is that whoever is writing these Proverbs, and we're pretty sure that Solomon had people who organized the stuff. I don't find it at all a violation of inspiration that Solomon writes the Proverbs and that editors may have compiled them. There's evidence in the Proverbs themselves. There's a place where it says the Proverbs of Solomon are ended. And then they go to another wise man. So there were probably compilers who put the Proverbs together. What do you think the odds are that the editor was such a numbskull that he picked two completely contradictory statements and put them right next to each other? Is that believable? If you're that inept, okay, they got you cleaning the fish gate or something. You're not compiling the Proverbs, okay? You're not qualified for the job. What happens in Proverbs when you put two statements like this right next to each other? Don't answer a fool according to his folly. Answer a fool according to his folly. What's the wise man doing? He's making you stop and think, right? He's going, you know, there's some complexity here. There are times when you don't answer a fool. There are other times when you do. So when should you and when should you not? And what he has done is lay the groundwork for you to have a conversation in your head and to think about the depth of these sayings rather than just reading over them real fast. That's a literary device. I put it under roundness of character. Yeah, I think it fits reasonably well there. Jesus is one with the Father. The Father is greater than I. Contradiction. Well, we've got a very complicated situation going on here. A member of the Godhead, co-equal with the Father and the Spirit, eternal with all the attributes of God, takes upon himself a human nature. That has never happened before, and as far as we know, it will never happen again. There's no indication in Scripture that one day the Father or the Spirit will become human. So this is an absolutely unique event. And in that human nature that he adds to himself are attributes that the person didn't have before. Most importantly, mortality, so that he can now die. Because only God can pay the penalty for sin, and only man can die. You got to have somebody who's both. To accomplish that transaction. So now he's mortal. There are indications in the gospel that a bunch of stuff is going on in that union of God and man that is extremely difficult to understand. Jesus says, the Father knows when I'm returning, but I don't. And every theologian's head explodes in that moment. How does that work? I have no idea. Thank you for your tuition money. But the answer to your question is, I don't know. Let me suggest that when we run into these moments where it's just beyond us, that's a feature, not a bug. And let me explain what I mean by that. If we could... God is infinite by definition. We are not by definition. We have trouble handling infinity. Let me just illustrate it very quickly. All the counting numbers, all the positive integers, 1, 2, 3... How many are there? Infinite. All right. There's always one more. The negative integers, -1, -2, -3... How many of them are there? Infinite. If you put them together and throw zero in just for fun, is that bigger than the number of positive integers or the same size? Math people in the room? The two sets are the same size. They're both infinite. And I look at that and I say, come on, it's 2x plus 1. You got the positives and the negatives and you got the zero there. No. They're both the same size. We don't handle infinity well. Our brains aren't calibrated to handle that. Now, if our finite brains could understand everything about an infinite God, what would you suspect? We made him up. We made a God we could explain. But if he's infinite, and we're not, you would expect that at times he's going to go over the horizon of our understanding. And we're not going to be able to put that stuff together. And that's exactly what we find here. This is an argument for the existence of God. It is not a problem. During his time on earth, Jesus said, there are things I don't know. The man brings his son or servant to Jesus to be healed. And he says, these demons are bothering him. They throw him in the fire. And Jesus says, remember what he says? How long has he been like this? Well, don't you know? Well, it's possible that he knew, but he wanted everybody else around to know that this was a congenital condition. Possible. But he says, how long has he been like this? He goes over to the fig tree to see if there's any fruit on it. Well, didn't he know from across the courtyard that there was no fruit on that tree? Well, maybe he just wanted the disciples to see that there was no fruit on it. But there in Mark, he says, I don't know when I'm coming back. Only the Father knows that. We don't know what's going on. How can you be omniscient and not know something? I can understand how you could be omnipotent and not use your superpower. Right? I have super strength, but I'm not going to use it. How can you not know something you know? Some theologians say that Christ voluntarily gave up the independent exercise of some of his divine attributes. And every word in that sentence is critical. And he placed his omniscience in the hands of his Father, and he depended on his Father to tell him what he needed to know to accomplish his mission. Is that how it worked? I don't know. Thanks for your tuition money. We're dealing with an infinite God here, and we're well out of our league. Is that a contradiction? Let me observe something. Riley. I do not understand this thing. Therefore, it must be false or illogical. That sentence is not the same as this sentence. I do understand this thing, and it is illogical. I know that it is illogical. That second statement makes sense. It can be true. The first sentence is a fallacy. It's saying, I am the standard by which the logic of the universe is evaluated. I must be able to understand all things. Well, if you understand all things, you're omniscient. You just proved that you're God, and you just proved the existence of God. So you lose the argument right there. I don't understand how Jesus could not know something if he's God. But that doesn't mean it's illogical. It means I don't understand it. That's what it means. So, not a contradiction. Okay, let's summarize the contradictions issue. Scripture claims to be inspired, or as we noted Sunday night, expired, breathed out by God. And inerrant, the Scripture cannot be broken. Jesus said that. The situations we've looked at here as suggested contradictions, I think, have been not at all difficult to deal with. There are some really difficult passages. Problem of evil is a difficult issue. The unity of God and man in Jesus is a difficult issue. Divine sovereignty and human responsibility, difficult issue. And until Jesus comes, there will be Calvinists and Arminians, and both of them will think that they're right. There are some difficulties in the biblical material. There are some things we don't know. Now, what do we do when we run into those? The ones I've given you last night and tonight are pretty easy to see through. What do you do when you don't know the answer? Let me tell you what typically happens in those circumstances. You have people who claim to be believers falling into two groups. One we might call the errantists. These are the people who say, well, you know, 30 divided by 10 is exactly 3. And so there must be a mathematical error in the Bible because pi is not exactly 3. They find something in the Scripture that they can't answer. And so they redefine the doctrine of inspiration to refer to faith and practice. The Bible is inspired with reference to faith and practice. All the religious stuff, it's accurate. And all the stuff you're supposed to do and not supposed to do, it's accurate. But math, history, science, that's not the purpose of the Bible. It's not trying to teach about that. So there can be errors of that sort. And we might call those the errantists. The trouble with that is, if the Bible has errors in science and history and math, then it has errors in doctrine too, because Jesus said the Scripture cannot be broken. It is inerrant. So this is a self-contradicting position. On the other side, we have the inerrantists. And you think I'm going to be on their side. Now, don't freak out on me, okay? I'm an inerrant. I believe in inerrancy. Absolutely. I've been arguing for it all week. But I don't agree with these people's position. Here's what they do. They figure out a way to come up with an explanation for all the difficult passages. And that sounds like a good idea. But in the process, they do some really weird gymnastics to try and get rid of the problem. Because This is a passage they don't have the answer to, and they're trying desperately to come up with an answer. Let me give you an example. In the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus prays, "Lord, Father, let this cup pass from me." Now, that's a theologically difficult passage. He came to die. He said that's the reason he came, to give his life a ransom for many. What's he doing here at the last minute asking to get out of it? That's a difficult passage. Now, for a number of years, there has been a theory out there. But what's going on here? He doesn't say, let the cross. He says, let this cup. So what's going on here is the devil, there are drops of blood on his forehead. Okay? The devil is trying to kill him in the garden so that he won't survive until tomorrow to die on the cross. And Jesus is aware of that. He feels the attack of Satan on him in the garden. And he says, let this cup pass from me so I can live until tomorrow to die on the cross. Well, that gets us out of the theological problem. But now we have a hermeneutical problem, a problem of interpretation. What's our problem? We just made the whole thing up. Right? There's no indication in the scripture that any of that is happening. And we're just making up fairy tales at this point, trying to get God out of a jam. God doesn't need your help. He's fine. And that means that we're not going to find answers to all the problems. Occasionally, one's going to come along, and we don't know the answer. And what do we do in those moments? We trust. I've been studying the Bible for 50 years, 47 professionally, that is, getting paid to do it. I have never been disappointed by trusting God. Never. I have disappointed Him plenty of times. He has never disappointed me. So when I come across something in the Bible I don't understand, I go, huh, that's interesting. We'll have to see what turns up. Let me give you some actual examples. For years, Bible critics said, Hittites, they got this big empire up north of Israel and all this power and influence. There's no archaeological evidence that Hittites ever existed. And then one day, somebody was digging in southeastern Turkey, and I think it was a potsherd, a piece of broken pottery that he picked up, and they used those as scrap paper back in the old days. And it said, Hittim. What do you know? We found the Hittites. And further exploration, we find out everything the Bible said about the influence of the Hittites was absolutely accurate. Absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. Huh? Now, when this happened, what do the critics do? They don't man up and hold a press conference and say, well, turns out there were Hittites and they were everything the Bible said and we were wrong and we'd like to apologize to all those people we made fun of. They don't do that. They just don't talk about the Hittites anymore and they go on to the next thing. Okay? That's how the game is played. What's the next thing? Moses couldn't have written the Pentateuch because there was no writing in Moses' day, 1450 B.C. And then it turns out that there was. Oops. Okay, these are both links, and there are articles linked here in the PowerPoint. They'd give you the details about those things. But you know, you see that kind of thing happen enough times, and you stop being afraid when you bump into something you don't know. You say, well, okay, we'll see what... Nobody knows. The unbelievers don't know. The believers don't know. We'll just have to wait and see what we find and what we learn and how it turns out. And I'm not worried. So Some people think that's blind faith. It is not blind faith. I have linked here to an illustration from Charles Ryrie's book, Basic Theology. If you click on the link, you won't see the story, but there's a button there that says Search Inside, and if you click on that button, you'll get the illustration. Man comes home from work early one day, and there's a car parked in front of his house that he doesn't recognize. And he gets out of his car and he slams the door, and on the sound of the door slamming, a man he doesn't know appears in the doorway of his house. And let's just for fun say that the man is tall and has a full head of hair and is astonishingly good looking. And the man sees him, looks horrified, runs to the strange car, starts it up, squeals the tires, and tears off down the street. Now, what's this guy going to think? That's a trick question. You don't know the answer. What he's going to think depends entirely on the nature of his relationship with his wife. If he and his wife have a healthy relationship, he's going to think, my birthday's next week. I bet she hired a party planner. I have to be sure and act surprised when the party happens. Okay. But if the relationship is not healthy, his thoughts are going to go in a very difficult, very different direction. Now, let me get real here. If every time you come across something about God that you don't understand, he's beyond the horizon of your intelligence, and you don't know what he's up to, and the first thing you think is, this is not good. This is not good. I don't trust this person. That tells you that your relationship with God is not healthy. And you need to get in the Word, the means of grace, the body of believers, and you need to work out on the Bible machine with weights on it. It is not naive for me to trust my wife. It is not blind faith for me to trust her. She has been my wife for 38 years, almost 39. She has proved herself to me. And I would be wrong not to trust her. Suppose I come home one day and say, so, what'd you do today? Well, I went here, I went there, I did this and that. I go out the front door and she says, where are you going? I said, I'm going to check the odometer in the van. I want to see if the miles driven matches up with what you just told me. And the women are going, oh. That is not a relationship, is it? That's stalking. Right? And what's her proper, justifiable response? I am your wife. You will not treat me that way. And she's right. What do you think it does to the heart of God when every time he does something that we don't understand, we go, what are you doing to me? Is this going to hurt? What do you suppose that does to his heart? I've been good to you for years. What does it take for you to trust me? Okay, I could go the rest of the night on this topic, but I've got just 50 minutes left to do fulfilled prophecy. But I was ready for that possibility, and I'm prepared to pare this down to just a few minutes if I have to, but I don't have to. So, I want to talk about fulfilled prophecy. There is justifiable, testable, verifiable evidence in the Scripture. Excuse me. I cannot let that slide.
fulfilled prophecy. There is a stray character in there. Where did it come from? I spent 20 years as an editor. I can't let this slide. I don't know why I'm not able to delete it. It's a square root, or it's a radical symbol sitting there, and different point size. Where did it come from? How did it get there? We need the truth sleuths to help us. Okay. Here's the thing. There are prophecies made in the Old Testament. Hundreds of years. Sometimes thousands. Yeah. Thousands of years. The seed of the woman shall crush the serpent's head. Thousands of years before fulfillment. We can verify that the prophecy is that old, and we can verify that it has been fulfilled. That's evidence. And you can't claim to be scientific and ignore the evidence that argues against your thesis, your hypothesis, if we're using science talk. So I'd like to look at some examples. There are scores of them. Just between the Old Testament and the New Testament, there are actually two events in history in particular that are special focuses of Old Testament prophecy. They've already happened. Okay? Now, what two events? One in the Old Testament, one in the New. Prophesied multiple times. Yes, ma'am. The exile and return, and particularly Babylon, the Judean exile. Yeah, I should say the Judahite exile. Judea didn't come along until late. Particularly the Babylonian exile. What's the other one? It's fulfilled in the New Testament. The anything of the first advent of Jesus. The crucifixion, the death, the resurrection, a bunch of other stuff. All kinds of prophecies made about the first advent, the first coming of Christ. What I'd like to look at is a couple of particular prophecies that are easy to remember because they both involve the number 70. And one of them refers to the Babylonian exile, and the other refers to the first advent of Christ. I've got a bunch of other ones here that we can talk about if we have time, but I want to start with those two because they're rock solid. Now, I'm going to need to bore you for a minute. Can you ever forgive me? I need to give you a bunch of dates. Okay? And that's the stereotype of the bad history teacher. But I'm going somewhere with this, okay? There's something really good at the end of it, so bear with me. There were three invasions by the Babylonian armies into Judah, at which times they took Judahites out and deported them to Babylon. They happened about 10 years apart, okay? First one was in 606 B.C. That's the one where Daniel and his buddies went. The second one is about 596. That's the one that Ezekiel went. And the third one is what they call in California the big one, 586. The city is destroyed. The temple is destroyed. The place is left in ruins. Okay. Third time's the charm. Okay, they're about 10 years apart. 538 BC, Babylon falls to Persia. You read about that in Daniel, Belshazzar's feast. The Persian armies come in under the wall of Babylon through the riverbed. You can read about that in Herodotus. The Babylonians are all drunk at the feast. They're not fighting worth anything. And the city is overthrown in a single night. Cyrus is the Persian ruler who overthrows Babylon. That's 538 BC. Now, Cyrus, for ancient Near Eastern emperors, is remarkably enlightened. It occurs to Cyrus that you might have fewer problems with rebellions. Okay, when you're ruling over a bunch of conquered peoples who don't want to be in your country, there's going to be a lot of rebellion, a lot of hatred, right? It occurs to him that there might be fewer rebellions if the people are happy. Who'd thunk? So he issues a decree that all of the displaced peoples in this empire that he's just conquered can return to their homelands if they want. It was standard policy in those days that you moved people around so that they'd intermarry with other peoples in other places and lose their sense of ethnic identity. And that way they'd be less likely to rebel. That's the theory. Well, Cyrus goes another direction. He says, if you want to keep your ethnic identity and go home and live in your homeland, do that. And so there's a whole bunch of conquered peoples in the old Babylonian Empire that return to their homelands. And the one that we're concerned with is the Jews. Within a couple of years, Zerubbabel, who's the grandson of the last Davidic king, leads a return to Jerusalem. You can read about it in Ezra chapters 1 through 5. They rebuild the altar. They start the sacrifices again. They'd been 50 years with no temple, 50 years with no sacrifice. As far as they knew, 50 years with no forgiveness of sin. So the first thing they do is build the altar. You can read about it there. That's in 536 BC. They run into some opposition on the matter of rebuilding the temple. And for 16 years, the temple continues to lie waste. Haggai and Zechariah show up in 520 BC. And you can read about this in Haggai. The construction begins in 520 BC. And 4 years later, they dedicate the second temple. Okay, that's a whole list of dates. Here's why I ran through all of that. Jeremiah had prophesied that they would be in Babylon for 70 years. I've given you a couple of references there. I won't go there. The first deportation was 606. The first return is 536. That's 70 years. The destruction of the temple is 586. The dedication of the second temple is 516. That's 70 years. That rascal Jeremiah was right twice with the same prophecy. Now, you might be thinking, well, you're cherry-picking your numbers. You're picking numbers that are 70 apart, and then you're saying, ooh, that's... Well, okay. Let's think about that. If you're going to date an exile, what are you going to date it from to? Well, the first deportation and the first return is the first thing you'd think of. And if this exile involves... a piece of architecture that is at the center of the culture being destroyed and then rebuilt, well, that would be a pretty good candidate too. I really don't think I'm cherry picking the numbers. Jeremiah was right twice with the same prophecy. The 70-year exile in Babylon. That's the first one. I really like that one because that is not something you can explain away. That is a remarkable coincidence. Okay.